Hello and welcome to Our Punch Drunk Loves, a podcast celebrating the films we adore. I am your host, Neil Bolt, and on Our Punch Drunk Loves, I'm joined by a guest who brings a film that they love so much it leaves them, well, punch drunk. Our combined task is then to discuss why that love exists and celebrate it. My guest this week is fellow film enthusiast who has regularly been chatting movies on this Discord of my other podcast, Safe Room. It's Matt Grisella. Matt, thank you for coming on. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me on here. So yeah, I want to talk about Sunshine from 2007 by Danny Boyle and written by Alex Garland.
Yes, that is definitely going to be an interesting talk, I must say, once we get into that. It's, Danny Boyle's got a very interesting catalogue of films anyway, and, you know, hopping from genre to genre. And this really sci-fi heavy one is quite an exciting one. But before we get to that bit, I always like to have a first-time guest answer a few general questions as a sort of cinematic mood board thing for them to get an idea of their tastes and things like that, which is just four questions, and your answers can be as long or as short as you like on this one. So, and it could even be, I don't know, if that's applicable. But I always start with, what was your first film memory?
Oh, let's see. My first film memory was probably seeing Star Wars on, just the VCR at home. Either that or Land Before Time. So got one or two of them. So
that's fair enough. Yeah. Dinosaurs and Star Wars. They are staples of many a Bourne film.
Yeah.
And Fiend. That's fine. Yeah, Star Wars is a pretty good one to have, to be honest, if you're going to start with something as iconic as that. So, yeah. And Land Before Time is one of those things that you often hear people bring up about. Oh, I remember that so fondly from my childhood. It's one of the first things I remember, stuff like this. It's crazy. I think everyone, it's hard to find someone who hasn't watched it as a result in their childhood at some point. I was going to say, have you ever seen that since your childhood?
No, I have not. But
That's the other thing. I'm not sure many people do. After that, it's like it was there. It's for everyone in their childhood. And then it just sort of saunters off into the sun, And I think there's like 20 of them or something now. But
there are, yeah.
So impressive. That franchise is doing something out there, that's for sure.
Yeah. Caused a lot of kids to try to eat leaves.
Yes. No, never did that. Not once.
No, not from experience. Ever, no.
Full carnival here. Don't do that. Okay, so next question is favorite genre. You can say more than one, obviously,
I would go horror, and I'm gonna smash fantasy sci-fi together because they genre bend a lot. Yeah, so, those are probably the easiest for me to name.
Yeah, I think we're on a good streak with horror. I think everyone who's been on so far has said horror as part of at least one of their genre picks. So that's probably just the circles I run in, isn't it? Right? Let's
be honest. Yeah, maybe.
But I think it's just that kind of genre. You can have a lot of appreciation for what it does, and and sci-fi again can dip its toes into horror and vice versa. So it's,
I think all three of them are very versatile.
Yeah, I mean that's probably what makes it work. I mean you can have elements of most genres appear in other things, but there's something that really works well with those. Can just, especially sci-fi and horror, which I think we've had as many great sci-fi horror movies as we've had genuine horror movies as well. It's like most of the ones that we like are based in some kind of science fiction, whether they be high fantasy levels or anything very basic, The Thing and Alien and all that, one sort of that. So I mean even Danny Boyle's own 28 Days Later, is technically sci-fi in how it's about a virus coming out and doing this stuff and no different than, say, like, you know, the Omega Man has a sort of scientific lean, and yeah, it can just be there in the background of horror nicely. So they always make good bedfellows, I think, when you've
yeah, for sure. Sort
of appreciate those kind of films. So next, favorite actors.
All right. For actors, that Timothy Oliphant is one of them.
Okay.
Yeah, he's the one who really brings me into when I watch Westerns. So
yeah, like, that's understandable.
Justified, Deadwood. I mean, it's just that will bring me out of the horror comfort zone, even though he's done quite a few horror movies.
Mm.
I do like almost all of Cillian Murphy's movies also, especially since, you know,
yeah.
We're talking about him today.
He's and, timely.
Yeah. Let's round it out with a third. I really like what Margot Robbie's been doing recently too.
So. Yeah. I've just been, actually in the previous episode, I had mentioned that when we were talking about certain actors having a certain quality like that, where you just slowly, gradually realize that you enjoy what they do more and more. And they tend to be the underrated ones, like Babylon recently for me, with her, they're just like great. You know, she did wonderfully in that. You know, it was, you know, I haven't seen stuff like, you know, Wolf of Wall Street or anything like that, but you know, whenever I've seen her in anything, it's tended to be like, yeah, she stood out, she's been good at it, like that. And yeah, you know, and Babylon for me, like, you know, with another actress I like in Samara Weaving, and that whole like, she's the next clone of that one, of that one, of that one sort of thing, and they play on that in that film, and it's really funny. She's fantastic. So that's, you can't go wrong there. Can't go wrong there at all. So, rounding it out, favorite director.
Start with kind of an easy one. Peter Jackson.
Yeah.
Obviously from Lord of the Rings, but also Dead Alive is one of my favorite movies of all time, or Brain Dead. And it's just so good that, like, it's just really serious high fantasy with Lord of the Rings, and then just whatever it is with Dead Alive.
I know. Got quite a flexibility for what he's done over the years as well, and like, a real like, I'll do what I want sort of thing. The more powerful he's become from it, you know. So I'll just get all this documentary footage from old Beatles things. Now that's my new hobby for the week, you know, like that sort of thing.
You know, he's got the catalog to back it up. You know,
yeah.
It's not like he went. He's like, oh, I'm going to do this, and everyone's like, wait, what? Kind of lost just there, because you know he's just been able to carry a following throughout his entire library.
Yeah, that early 2000 period of having Peter Jackson and Sam Raimi just being big blockbuster directors all of a sudden was just like wild. Yeah, you know, like,
yes.
At that point, like, you just look at them and go, yep, good on you. Good on you, lads. Like that. And when you see so many greats of like genre cinema, especially, and not end up getting that. And struggling one way or another, or feeling disillusioned because it's very different to what they were doing. It is, yeah, nice to at least see some people get that and take that shot, and yeah, and still retain a style. You know, Raimi was a great example of that, I think, especially when you think of those Spider-Man films, just still being him, intrinsically. And Jackson, I think, put a lot of what he'd done in those early days. Into the finer details and stuff of Lord of the Rings, you know, that eye for detail carried his way through. And, you know, he's as accomplished with directing drama as he is gore and horror and silliness, you know. So it's, yeah, a good sign. He has a respect for the spectrum of different types, I think, which is good to have as a director. If you're going to, you know, be able to make anything. Yeah, rather than just like a specific sort of genre.
For sure.
Okay, then. So that's the questions out of the way. And as you said, you have brought us Danny Boyle's Sunshine. You've already told us about the year and that, so we don't have to go through that bit yet. So, on the plot then, Sunshine is set in the year 2057, when the sun is kind of tapping out on us effectively, which is frightening to think now, because we've lost another like 16 years since then. So Earth is dying as a result in this. So what do? We do what we do best, don't we? We send a massive nuke to space to basically try and reignite it. Which, you know, as ideas go in cinema, is like not far off from send miners, you know, drillers to the fucking asteroid to blow it up thing. But you know, it's at least got a bit more substance, I suppose. So the first attempt that Earth has fails in mysterious circumstances. And now a new crew, with the absolute last of our explosive resources, takes a final shot at saving Earth, which will, of course, go absolutely swimmingly.
There's no way this could go wrong.
There is no way that it could go wrong. It's just perfect, isn't it? So this is an interesting one, isn't it? Because from the idea of what it's setting out, you know, it lays that screed out at the beginning about what's happened and why Earth is struggling, and they are just desperate at this point to give it a shot. And it's only become more timely the closer we get to that actual date in the film, because yeah, you think, well, we've got all these initiatives, we're trying to make it work like that. Back in then, we would have said this, and then you look at everything that's happened in the years after that, you're like, okay, well, we probably would just wait till the last minute and go, shit, well, we've got all these nuclear weapons, we don't have we've fucked the planet, so let's try and use all those to unfuck the planet. And yeah, it is the most interesting thing from the outset is that it feels plausible in a way that maybe it was a little less plausible back then, don't you think?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, when I first saw this back in 2007, it was like the premise of it did have a air of not silliness, but it, yeah, it definitely felt more like something like Armageddon, like, oh, we're gonna nuke the fucking sun. And now you're sitting there and it's like, no, yeah, I mean if this came on the news in 5-10 years, I would just kind of be like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, the only unrealistic thing about it is like, could you really see every country going, yeah, you will give up on nuclear materials just to do this? They'd be like, yeah, but what if the other country doesn't do it? Well, you don't want to do it like that. We'd probably just leave it. I mean, that's probably the only difference at this point. But maybe you just have to get that desperate to get to that point.
I mean, I kind of feel like there was, because they talk about the Icarus One is like, oh, we gathered, you know, I think they call it the size of the island of Manhattan worth of nuclear materials.
Yeah.
And they send that off and then it goes dark. And then I'm imagining they're like, you know, searching the couch cushions for all the rest of the nuclear materials.
I mean, yeah, it's how they explain it, isn't it? It's like, yeah, we just got everything. We found every last scrap of it. And it's like, you just imagine like this big, you know, like sticky ball of nuclear muck they've just found, you know, scraped off.
Yeah.
God knows what, you know. And yeah, it probably is at that point, because like, well, there's no use for it here if we can't, you know, use it.
Yeah.
I suppose at that point, when you've already got winter being everywhere, you don't really want to add nuclear winter to that as well. So I suppose therein lies the incentive.
Yeah, I think so. But, and I mean, it is interesting to see that we don't actually see, it doesn't start off on Earth ever. You know, the only time we see it is like in the last little bit of it. So, that's one thing I liked about it, but it's always focused on the crew and on the Icarus too. So they don't waste any time.
Yeah. I mean, I could see it working if they did sort of start with the whole, you know, the journey to getting to that point. But I think given that the way the story has started, they've managed to sort of jump that by saying, you know, they already sent a crew out. We've already been through this once. It's like, so, yeah, I like that. You know, that kind of just washes away the need for all the prep and the intensity of that. Yeah, and you can just go straight into this. You know, they're out there. And we're seeing them pretty much at the last point before, you know, they are not going to be able to see or speak to anyone for a long time. Like that, yeah. It's like the point of no return rather than the journey there, which I think, yeah, is it sets the mood perfectly for what is to come.
Yeah, and they start almost at Mercury, so it's... Yeah. And we don't feel like we really missed anything, because Kappa, who's Cillian Murphy's character, kind of has this monologue in the beginning, and you know, after the monologue, you feel like, okay, I'm caught up. Let's go.
Yeah, that's it. And you get a nice sense of in that opening sort of section where they are, everything is quite demure and quiet. Really, is that you get a feeling of how long they've been on there, you know, already. Like that. That little bit of cabin fever is there in certain people more than others, you know, and the tensions are high, and you know, I think they've been at 16 months by the time they're actually getting to this point, so yeah, long enough to be trapped in the same place as a few people where you can't ever go anywhere. It's gonna definitely send you a bit doolally on occasion.
Yeah. Spend a year and a half on you know, in cramped corners on a tube with people. It's,
yes.
You're going to get tired of some of them.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. And yeah, and so we basically are in that last 24 hours before, as we said, they are going to be in this dead zone, and they're allowed to send off their messages and things like that. And we get like that point of contention between, you know, Kappa and Mace, who is played by Chris Evans in a pre MCU fame sort of role. So yeah, it is, again, that's a really good example of just showing you how fraught everything is, and how even though they're doing this heroic thing, they kind of know in the back of their brain that it's almost a doomed voyage, you know, that they aren't likely to see their way back, you know, even though there have been these assurances and things like that, because it's such a desperate last attempt and there is nothing else to give and there will be no help. And to have been that far, you are leaving a lot of it up to luck. You know, it is voyaging beyond the known at that point. And it is certainly a thing that carries through the film quite well, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, you go and it's one of those things that even before everything starts to go bonkers, You do see that, yeah, this is fine until the last messages have to go out, and he goes, well, this is really real now. It's not the last 16 months where it's been, we're kind of on a ship, and then everything kind of comes to a head. One thing I do, this doesn't really fit in a whole lot, but I do wish that the second ship was called the Daedalus. Since the Daedalus was Icarus's father, who told him not to go that far. it's a small thing, but it's always one thing I was like, oh, that would have been nice.
Yeah, I mean, in naming conventions alone, it's already a bit like,
Yeah.
You were kind of asking for it at that point.
Yeah. But I liked that, but I also like how you get introduced to all of the characters quickly, but also fairly organically. It's not everyone sitting around the table going, yes, I am Kappa, I am the nuclear engineer. It's, you see Cyril, who's the doctor psychiatrist, going and in the sunroom kind of getting sun drunk, however you want to call it, and then you just kind of see how it's like, oh, this is this person, and I always liked how they're kind of just brought on. It definitely felt like the beginning of Alien or Event Horizon in that way.
Yes, yeah, you've got something there. I think something you brought up when you're sort of making notes for this is, you know, that use of loose science, you know, to make a more elevated and fantastic story, rather than leaning into that hard. I mean, we kind of alluded to that a little bit when we were saying, you know, how it feels a little silly back then, but, you know, now it kind of works because there's a swimmy logic to it where it's like, well, don't question it too much. You know, it's like all you need to know is if this doesn't work, it fucks up. That's it, you know, like that. And we have a very small window of not fucking this up. And yeah, that is just enough, I think, for the kind of story. They're allowing the characters to have the room to tell their story. Because we already know, you know, the idea is do the job like this. Any deviation from the job is going to make it difficult or impossible. And, of course, the way it goes out is the human element means that they have to deviate and things go wrong. That's a good use of science in that regard.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see how if you go into the 2010s, you see a lot more sci-fi that is trying to be a little more grounded. Like you see Martian, you see Moon, or to a lesser extent, like Interstellar. And this one is definitely more of a, oh, what if we have, you know, a giant, you know, room that's totally not the holodeck from Star Trek in it, where you can, you know, see waves.
I mean, I like that as an idea, because, you know, with the whole cabin thing, the idea to have like an escape memory-wise, it feels like a logical progression of the holodeck idea, where you are, no, it's there to stop you from going nuts in space, basically, rather than anything else. Yeah, you know, and that's basically what they use it for after that confrontation between Kappa and Mace, isn't it? That again is really good use of existing ideas in a scientific form, and just making them logical within that.
Yeah, it's like a one of those sad lamps that you can have for seasonal depression, but it's a room.
That's it, yeah. Mace has that very sort of specific thing, as you say, of the waves and people getting soaked in them, and the room basically nervously saying, "And you know, this is a bit much. You know, this isn't maybe going to give you the right reaction." I like that you know, with all the technology they've got, it's still technology that's giving an algorithmic idea of what you should be feeling in a situation, what would work for you. It's like, no one can explain why things that may seem destructive or wild are calming or pleasing to them. Yeah, you know, I think of thunderstorms, you know, like that. You know, I love that I can fall asleep to the sound of thunderstorms.
Oh, for sure.
No, but there are people who are terrified by that. And you know, this program is kind of like that. It's like this won't help. It's like, no, this will help me. He's insistent, and I like that it doesn't sort of bite back on it and say, no, you can't have this. So that was an interesting little wrinkle in that, you know. So going back to what we were saying though about that, with that fight that you have, you know, between them and this whole calming thing, you brought up this whole thing about the struggle between Kappa and Mace throughout the story. Yeah, where the story subverts what you call the more classic idea of an action hero. Yeah.
Yeah, so Mace is, it's a little unclear, but I think he's the pilot/engineer. He is a lot more of the classic action hero in this, because he's the one who wants to, you know, take charge, and I can go and I can lead this and everything. But at the same time, they know, they being the crew of the Icarus II, that if one person needs to survive the longest, it's Kappa. It's the person who can, you know, actually set off the nuke. So it's a very interesting, almost like guard the king kind of thing, like chess, where it goes and everyone else can do maybe more or something, but they know that this one person needs to be there, and that certainly happens throughout the entire movie.
Yeah, and I think that's what kind of leads to that tension early on with the recordings, you know, where Kappa takes too long because he's not able to put his thoughts into it, because he knows that, you know, he's the one that has to be the whole way through this, and that's the, you know, the pressure's on his shoulders, and if it goes wrong, it's doomed. You know, that can make others feel insecure about, you know, their place on the mission, you know, which is, say, you know, quite a important sort of piece in many great sci-fi films, with crews like that where they are this sort of, you know, as they put, truckers in space to a degree. And you know, you always get the people that are slightly lower down the pecking order that know their job, understand what their job is, but it doesn't stop them getting frustrated by, you know, feeling insignificant and feeling like their time is worth less, you know. And I think that's Mace's sort of, you know, hothead thing there. I mean, though he is sort of an engineer, I think the suggestion is he has some sort of military background as well, which is why a lot of the way he comes to ideas and plans tends to feel quite, you know, military-like, you know, as well. So, yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, as you say, and you wouldn't expect it to go the way it does in that regard in terms of who is going to be the guy. But yeah, they do make brilliant sense of why Capper is being sort of thrust into, you know, the title role involuntarily, if you know what I mean. He knows he's not that guy, but he has to be for this story. And again, this is another thing that just sort of lends the science of it, this logic, and, you know, it helps it make more sense. The more and more thing, little decisions like this in the storytelling just make it feel right. Because, you know, if it was like an Armageddon thing, then yeah, Chris Evans would 100% be like, I'm the super brothin brain genius. And I also happen to be a luchador in my spare time sort of thing. It'd be like that. Yeah. Like that. Yeah, and it's just not. And that's what's refreshing at that time, especially, I think, when sci-fi was big and silly again, and that's fine, but you kind of want to have some stuff that's more alien than, you know, Star Wars in your sci-fi sometimes. And
I mean, I feel like a really good part where it kind of shows that is the scene when Harvey, the comms officer, is like, oh, we found the Icarus One, and they're trying to decide what to do with it, what to do with the information. And it's Mace and Cyril and Kaneda, Kaneda's the captain, is they're having this conversation going back and forth of, oh, should we go get the Icarus One? Should we not? Should we do this? And in the end, it goes, no, we're going to have Kappa decide. And Kappa's not even in the shot at the table. He's like sitting on a bench in the corner. And he looks up, he's like, wait, what? And you kind of go and you're like, oh, okay. Even though, you know, he's not the big, strong, like outspoken hero type, you know, he's still the one who has to decide.
Yeah.
And I always liked that that scene because it definitely kind of plays with the expectations a little bit.
Yeah, it does. So yeah, we get through all that and everything's calms down a bit. We get the first of many problems after that, you know, once they do go past that dark side, you know, where Corazon notes that the ship is maybe, you know, 2/3 of the way, but everything should be good in terms of like oxygen. They should be going great. Everything should be right for them to go back. But then you get the whole thing with Searle, you know, who, as you know, as you said, we're talking about the looking at the sun for a bit too long and like almost like a drug the sun has treated, or a god.
Yeah.
You know, the whole time where, you know, it just wants to spend as much time bathing in it. And, you know, we find this is like an effect that it's had on people, you know. It's great that he just sort of, you know, it's just little touches that sort of, and you know, the drug touch being, you know, like, oh, well, you know, you can only have this much exposure for this amount of time. But again, being computers, what being what they are, is like, they don't say that you can't keep doing it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like 30 seconds, yeah, okay, 30 seconds this time, and then 30 seconds next time, like that. And the computer's not going to sort of pick that up, which is a really good way of showing, again, the holes in relying on technology to keep you safe from yourself.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing that's great about that is, you know, he starts with, you know, just him, and then he puts on his like aviators, and then in the next scene where you see him, and he has like welding goggles, and then at the, maybe it's at that scene, or maybe it's when they find out about the it's when Kappa decides he's start like picking at his skin because he's getting like this like nasty sunburn from being in there too long. And you're just like, oh, so would you just keep doing that if this movie hadn't happened? Like, would he have kept escalating?
Yes.
And then, you know, would it?
Yeah. I suppose half the answer is in what comes later and learning the fate of the Icarus One. Is like that. Probably, yeah. carried on as long as he could. But I mean, we do come to that not long after this, of course, you know, because Canada is trying to look at the video logs of the previous captain, you know, to try and figure out what's happened. And you know, there's a hint where Pinbacker's basically said the other captain describes like a meteor shower has happened. It's done a little bit of superficial damage. And yeah, that's fine. He's a bit perturbed by the fact that he's not very concerned, you know, by what's happened. So still, you know, there's an air of mystery left to it at that point. So yeah, as you say, once they get to Mercury, you know, close enough, that's where the signal starts coming in. And that is a point I really wanted to get into, is that distress signal noise is beautiful. And a beautiful little piece of sound design, you know, just that little beep, 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 beep is, ironically, it's just used very similarly in the game Bulletstorm. You know, there's a part in that game where it has that same sound. It's almost exactly the same. I always have that weird sort of feedback association between the two things, you know, where it's like I hear it in one thing, it's like, oh,
very different sci-fi.
Very, very different sci-fi. That is like Armageddon invading Sunshine in that case.
Oh, that's kind of funny.
So obviously they had that debate, as you said, and as you say, a really fascinating debate in terms of like the hierarchy and, you know, the reluctance of some people to really get involved in that political side of it, if you will. And so they make the decision, obviously, to just change course, do that stuff. And you know, that turns out to be a bad idea, doesn't it? Because we get a very extreme case of fucking up your job when the panels at the front of the ship that have been keeping them safe from the sun aren't realigned properly, and you get some unfortunate moments in that one. That is just, when you've watched the film once at least, that's really the point where you go, there we go. This is the slow descent to hell that they are going on, because it is like the first domino in the chain of everything that happens. And it's caused by, basically everything that's gone on already, where they are already like, oh shit. Yeah, we aren't in our tip-top physical form, with this, and it just goes so badly like that. It's an interesting part of the story, isn't it? Because they really turn this into probably one of the best set pieces, I think, in the film, where they are trying to go and fix it like that, and they really sell the tension of, being out there, and only being protected from the sun by the fact that you are behind these panels, but also having to fix these panels before anything goes wrong. And so, it's Canada and Kappa that go out in the suits. Those spacesuit designs, beautiful. Yeah, like that.
I call them the Golden Turtle suits, and they are one of my favorite pieces of sci-fi, I guess you'd call it costuming, it's just so cool, but so you can't do anything in it.
Yeah, and it's it makes sense visually as well. Again, the way they look, because they are to protect you from this and this, like that. And I love that. And there's tiny visors and the baker foil outside. It's brilliant. It looks like that, because again, it's just if you really thought about it, it's like, well, maybe that wouldn't work because of this and this. But on that surface level thing, it's it makes sense they would look like that. Don't have to get too much into why or how they work and where their limitations lie. I think the main thing we can all agree with here is when you're that close to the sun, it's not going to do any good, really. And as it shows, you know, it does not do any good. But yeah, it is the first sort of break in the chain, and we get this. Well, it goes wrong. That's the best way to put it. Again, you know, is that things take a bit of a turn here, don't they? Where they're trying to get the shades right with the Icarus II so that they don't get cooked alive, basically. And Cassie, who's a Rose Byrne's character, isn't it? Yeah. Again, I think that was like one of her early roles as well. So
yeah, it was.
Yeah, one of those things we've said about this film is just like cast feels stacked by modern standards now, because there's just so many people
who go,
hey, it's that guy, it's that guy, that girl, like that. It's brilliant, you know?
The fact that this movie, you know, in 2007, it goes, oh yeah, it's, you know, it's Danny Boyle and Alex Garland, the people who did 28 Days Later, and it's Cillian Murphy, yeah, that guy from, you know, 28 Days Later, and it's Chris Evans, the guy from Not Another Teen Movie. Sure. And you have people, but now like everyone's been in like superhero movies and, you know, blah blah blah. Like it's now just a huge movie, like thing of how crazy big some of these people have gotten.
Yeah, and like it's weird echoes out into the careers they have afterwards in terms of what they're doing. You know, Cillian Murphy being like the most interestingly relevant one now, considering, you know,
yeah,
the role he's playing, you know, what he's doing, you know, like it's, you know, like Oppenheimer, the sci-fi movie, you know, as a result. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, different, obviously, permutations, but it's funny that you just have that. And it was like, ironically, the film I watched after rewatching this, that I rewatched as well, was the sci-fi alien knockoff Life with Reynolds and Jake Gyllenhaal. And of course, one of the funny things about that is that Hiroyuki Sanada, who plays Captain Canada, is in that as well. So, and he gets killed very early on. You know, he's famously the guy that gets killed at the end of Ring, you know, as well. So it's like, he's somewhere, he's doomed, basically, in American cinema, especially, it seems.
Or it's a noble sacrifice.
Yes, you know? Like in John Wick 4. Yes.
Yeah.
he's Japan's Sean Bean, it seems now. So.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, they have a malfunction on the Icarus II that sets, you know, breaks a fire out, basically. And you know, now you have a problem, because if they don't deal with it properly, you know, it could take out the entire garden they've got, which of course is their oxygen supply and all like that. And of course, then the ship decides it's going to go back to its own automatic piloting. So of course the ship starts turning as they're still out there working on fixing the panels. And unfortunately that means that at that point, you know, as we were just saying, someone has to die at that point.
Yeah.
Canada is the one that ends up getting turned into a very expensive space turkey, you know, at that point. So it's, yeah, the intensity of those scenes, really amazing. You know, I'm still like taken aback by how it kind of just, you know, does kind of leave you on the edge of your seat to a degree, because you are just there going, maybe this time they'll make it like that. Up until the point, you know, where he pretty much resigns himself to, nah, fuck it, I'm dead. So, not like that.
Yeah.
Which, you know, happens a lot in this movie. Yeah, like, I love that.
It does, yeah. It's a lot of well, this is it for me, but, you know, the show has to go on. And guess what, you know, Kappa has to be the one to make the show go on, so.
Unpleasant, isn't it? Like, you know, the way things start going wrong from this point, it just escalates. God, yeah, I think we just lose people left, right, and center pretty much after this.
Yeah.
Before we even get to the Icarus one. It's like, Yeah, so you have a lot going on at that point. But I suppose the thing that's been great about that to this point is visually how well this film is telling a story. You know, it is one of the understated things about this is all throughout, there is such a wonderful use of visual style to sort of get you into the right mood and the right atmosphere of what the film is doing. And that scene, you know, where they are trying to repair the cells is just more intense because of the way they flare the sun, the way that they show you how the gradual turn is just so deadly. Yeah. And just the meanness of just showing you how cruel. There's no like build up to when things go wrong in a lot of cases. It's just like, nope, there it is. It happened like that. Very matter of fact. Like the fire breaking out like that, and it feels like a cruel thing, you know, in the best way possible. Yes, so we've said that. We said about the spacesuits being wonderful. That repair scene, as we said, is just frightening at that point.
Yeah.
So the thing I suppose we've really got to get to is... Yeah, now we are coming to the Icarus One. We know we have to go there now because everything is basically fucked aboard the Icarus Two. They don't have enough oxygen. They don't have this. They don't have that. They've got to try, and go there to see if they can, maybe get stuff off there to live again. And yeah, so that's basically what they do. They get to them. After having this horrible conversation about, there's enough air for this amount of people, then, and basically saying, this person might not be important, or this might not be important. But they go into Icarus One, and it is just horrible. Dusty. Again, scientifically, they say, that wouldn't happen because blah, 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 but in real life. But it looks great. Exactly. At the time, you're like, good effect, works well, and, given whatever else has happened in there. This is where they start using that Exorcist trick of image flashes, occasionally just having these images of stuff that's happened on the ship and of Pinbacker, who will come into it later. And it is a really good scene. It changes the film again. You've had this serene start, you've had the tension, then you've had the intensity of it starting to go wrong, and then it takes this sideways shift to cosmic horror, basically, which has been hinted at this point, with the whole obsession with the sun, and that in itself feels very, in the realms of cosmic horror at that point. Aboard this place is just something else. Once you get past all the dustiness, just every little detail they find out about it, everything's fine here, this shouldn't be like this, or they find stuff being okay, like the garden being overgrown basically with all this stuff, and it just becomes more and more of a mystery. And they find the sunroom, don't they? Yeah, basically, and knowing that they would have been doomed had they not come on in the right way, and not had been blocked out by the Icarus Two as well. So yeah, there is that. Then you have the airlock thing, which is just horrifying, in its own way. The connecting thing basically between the two ships gets destroyed somehow, and they're pulled apart, and they've only got one suit to get back. One suit, and then they just try this stuff, which was funny again because around the same time I was watching Guardians of the Galaxy 3. And they do that bit very similar at the end of Star-Lord.
Yeah.
And he completely fluffs it, and it's still a bit like that. And, it made me laugh that they try this, in this Just wrap yourself in all this shit and see if you can live long enough through space. And it almost kind of works until, obviously, trajectory doesn't take in quite the same place. And again, just a real sign of that cruelty that this film has, where it feels like it's playing with your expectations constantly. Like, that's where it feels more like a horror in those moments where it does just kill people off by, well, they think they got hope if they do it this one way. And then, the minute you get a bit of hope, it's torn away in the most cruel and horrific way possible. And poor Harvey ends up drifting off out of space. That was not nice. Yeah, that's up there with drowning in the ocean in terms of the horrors of these wide open spaces, and just you don't want to be left out in the middle of nowhere like that. It's just, how did you feel about that whole airlock scene?
Yeah, so I always love that airlock scene because I think it shows it really shows all four of those characters' true colors.
Yeah.
The four characters being Cyril, Mace, Kappa, and Harvey. And because they're like, oh, well, it's one suit, and it's almost like they're figuring out, okay, one person's going to get through and the rest of us are going to have some descending order of might die. And Harvey, who was the comms officer and is quote unquote the captain now, has this kind of meltdown of just like, no, I'm the captain. I'm going to take the suit and, something, something, step three profit about doing this. And he gets shut down, obviously. And then they go and do the everyone wrap yourself in whatever the insulation is.
Yeah, basically. And hope for the best.
I have written in my notes of say the spacesuits from wish.com. So
yes, basically. Yeah. Oh man.
And then finding out that you need to leave someone on the Icarus One to actually cycle the airlock because that's rough.
It is. I think the two things to mention in this whole thing on the Icarus One, where they view that video log of Pinbacker, where he's showing very obvious signs of over sunburn. And basically finding other crew members being burned to death, and how he's ranting about this being God's will that everything was destroyed. Yeah, and that's when they find out that they were lucky that they planted the Icarus 2 in front of the Icarus 1, because that would have just cooked them effectively the second they got on. And Searle ends up being the one, of course, to stay behind, and which, everything we know about him at that point makes sense, that he's like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to go cook. I want that.
I'm going to get a little sun.
Yeah. I want that beautiful final exposure to the sun. It's it just makes perfect sense because, he's drunk on it. He is just trying to get that next high of now I can have access to it unrestricted with no one telling me what to do like that. And I love this idea that the sun is so captivating the closer they get, and probably because it's grown in importance. Now it is playing like that, and to feel this warmth and this dazzling wonder of being so close to it, more close than any person had been before. And you can see how people could lose their minds about that so easily. So we've kind of been prepared for that, by that point, being in the sun room and someone actually just being cooked like that. So it was it was coming, and it worked just as it should by that point. When it does,
it was coming. Dear. It went there, and we're all here for it. Well, Not sure for a year for it, but knew it was going to happen.
Yeah. So yeah, they end up having, obviously, another discussion about how much oxygen they have and to complete the mission. And yeah, there are five of them left, only enough for four. And they, again, just decide very coldly about who's going to have to die and who's going to have to kill someone else. And basically decided that Mace will have to kill Trey, and finds out that Trey's already figured this out himself and decided to make the choice a bit easier for them. I mean, that in everything that's so like this film, we've already said, you know, where everyone is so accepting of their fate when it's coming like that. And again, this way, you know, again, is another sort of suicidal death when you think about it. Everyone who tries to figure out if they can get out of this accepts it on some level and finds a very inventive way out generally. But yeah, this is a bit bleakly old-fashioned, unfortunately, for this one.
Yeah, this one is this is a very bleak scene. It does go back to a little bit of how you mentioned earlier how Mace might have a military background, because it's that whole thing of, oh, we can't just talk about killing this one person. And it is, Mace is like, no, this is going to happen and I can do it. Yeah. Like, it's very much putting that weight on himself. And then it's already happened. So, but you have that really sad scene with Trey in the Earth room. And, also he's been really, they say he's been like heavily medicated since Kaneda's death, because he blames himself for basically this whole cascade happening.
Yeah, for not planning it right at first. Yeah, with that. Like, I mean, he has a very heartfelt, hysterical rant when it's figured out that he's miscalculated, you know, like that. And he realizes the enormity of everything that's happened with that, you know, that his decision has caused major damage to the mission and probably to their lives at that point. And no way to hide at that point. And you kind of understand that he would do it at that point. And it's almost his last way of trying to give them hope of finishing it. You know, that, which, again, bleak as it is, it goes back to this cold logic that we keep getting in this film, you know, and that acceptance of, you know, we're not doing this for us. We're not doing it to be heroes. We're doing it because the Earth needs this to survive. And we kind of knew this was going to be a one-way mission, one way. And yeah, I think it's just a case of like, well, either I'll go out the way I want to, or I'll die trying, sort of thing. And pretty much most deaths in this film, some form of that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in between all this, it becomes very aware that Pinbacker is not dead, and has made his way onto their ship now. And yeah, we get a bit slasher happy with the film now as he comes on. Now, one of the interesting things about this change is visually, you know, once he's involved, yeah, you know, we were talking about those Exorcist style image flashes burning into the main visuals that we're getting, you know, which again is very reminiscent of the sun anyway. Yeah. You know, Pinbacker in general, you know, as a visual treatment, you can't focus on it. Yeah, you know, the idea is, you know, you can't focus on him like the sun, because the sight of him would just scar you, and you kind of have to look away, and if not, it burns into your eyes. And he is like this physical acolyte for the sun, you know, at that point. And that basically bleeds into the way every scene is shot when he's in it. You know, everything becomes blurred, distorted, and yeah, you said yourself in the notes for this that it's a big part of the change in tone.
Yeah.
Once then, because it does do really well to sort of signify that, you know, that he's the presence he brings and the fact they're getting closer to the sun, you know, as well, I think helps as well to change it from being very steady, very methodical, to just being wilder and more heated. You know, it is very much like that, isn't it?
Yeah, the two things I think about with this and how they kind of record Pinbacker is, first is back is earlier when Kappa is trying to run a simulation of what will happen when they nuke the sun, the heat distortion makes the simulation go all sorts of like kind of shifty and like really out of focus, and it says, oh, I can't, basically after this point I'm guessing. And it does that, but also it almost makes you seem like the heat is like distorting the film itself.
Yes.
Showing this and kind of causing this distortion, which I know when it came out did get some criticism because people were like, oh, this doesn't, you know, this makes like these scenes really hard to watch. And I mean, I understand where that comes from, but I don't really think that if it was just, you know, 100% sunburned Pinbacker, just kind of regular, I don't think you could have this level of tension to it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's...
He's almost ethereal at that point, isn't he? He's not...
Yeah.
He almost feels like something more. Yeah. Than he's, yeah. He's like the haunting of the failure of the previous mission. And it's... Yeah, it's basically cursed them, effectively, by even going near the Icarus One.
Yeah, because it's... For most of his inclusion, it is not like a... It is... There are parts where the cast interacts. There's a quote unquote fight scene with Rose Byrne. I forgot her character's name. Oops.
Oh, Cassie. Yeah.
Cassie in the Earth Room. And with Corazon in the wreckage of the garden.
Yeah.
But for a lot of times, Pinbacker's kind of moving around the ship, not, you know, kind of messing with things. Or the scene where he chases Kappa, and it's definitely more of a, yeah, it's more of a haunting, more of like a running from something,
yeah,
and not really treating it as, oh yes, Pinbacker, the other person, you know, it's he's never treated as a character, obviously.
No, the only instance, I suppose, is when they're talking about the oxygen and like they're saying, oh yeah, yes, we've got enough for four, and they're saying, no, there's a fifth person in it, sort of thing. That's the only time it's really directly acknowledged like that.
And, but the deadpan way that Icarus, the voice of Icarus, just says, no, there are five people. Well, wait, who's the fifth person? I don't know. And you're just like, wait, what? Yeah,
That whole thing in this film, which is like technology being only good enough to a level, you know, like that, it's amazing. It's like, it's easy to rely on it, you know, like in the comfort of your own home or whatever. But yeah, once you're going out into space, the deepest regions of space, trying to reignite the sun, suddenly it doesn't feel quite so comforting as a tool to help you out when it can't even tell you who the fuck's with you. So.
Oh, who's on the ship? I don't know. The fifth person. Come on. Don't you know?
Hey, only 30 seconds watching the sun at this height. Yeah, it's like, it doesn't matter about how many 30 seconds you do. Just only 30 seconds. Fine.
Just 30 seconds. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Which I love because, yeah, it is all, you know, it comes down to one thing. It's like humans designed it. There are going to be flaws because that's natural.
Yeah.
You know, like that. It's, if you're doing sci-fi, it's one of two ways. It's either it has flaws because, you know, in the technology, because humans have made it, or, you know, it learns on its own speed and then it's flawed because it's murderous or something. You know, that's the way it goes. And this one is very much a... much more in the alien camp of like matter of fact, just doing my job thing, you know, like that. And I will do the basics, not question it. I haven't got a clue beyond what I've been told. That's it. And yeah, it feels so bleakly perfect that there are these little oversights, yeah, about like that, because you just wouldn't expect certain things. You're like, why would anyone else be invading the ship in the middle of space? It's like, of course not. We don't need to put anything in for that. Yeah, we know who's on board. And it makes sense, but it's also just funny that you just have those moments like that.
Yeah, and I mean, this brings up coming up next is probably one of my favorite scenes from this entire movie is Pinbacker goes and he takes the server racks out of like their little coolant, like their coolant water, and then busts the controls. So basically, the AI in the ship will overheat, and it means that Mace has to dive into the coolant and try to break them to bring them back in. And it is just, I mean, in a movie that is filled with like heroic sacrifices, I mean, this one just stays with me for so long because of how bleak and prolonged and sadly futile that it is. What do you think of this scene?
Yeah, again, it goes back to that cruelty that this film has, this mean streak where he's, as you say, he does that very heroic thing of going in that thing, and you already have this almost that wonderful thought of like, oh yeah, the ironic thing, you could probably drown in space. Yeah, that's fucking, that would be just,
yeah.
That's in itself just feels like ironically high horrifying. And then it's like, or freezing to death in space, but not outside in space or whatever. And like, yeah, just doing enough to get out of it to a degree. But yeah, the minute the leg's trapped, it's like, just like everything else, you're there again, shit, like that. It's like, and now, yeah, it's even weirder because, yeah, it's Chris Evans. You're like, oh shit, that's Chris Evans.
Yeah.
Like that. And again, this is one of the weird things of watching Life again afterwards, where it's again, very much a film doing the same thing in that regard, where it's like, oh shit, they've killed Ryan Reynolds in the set already, like that. But at the same time, Chris Evans wasn't that big then.
No.
So it doesn't, it's more logical that he would, whereas Life, it feels more like, I kind of can't connect with it in the same way, because Ryan Reynolds has died and it kind of feels like a move to have him die like he does and for everyone to die like they do in that film, because they're all bigger stars at that point. But here it's just like, Chris Evans was likable enough and probably still one of the more notable members of the cast. So it was surprising enough, and that's what matters here. And I think yeah, at this point in the film, it's like they've shown, it's like, yeah, people are just gonna die left, right and center. And as we've been saying this whole sort of time, it's that's the mission. Yeah, it's like everyone's gonna check out in some way, shape or form. It's just how they get there, and it shouldn't be as cruel and unusual as it ends up being for most people, but it's probably better than the alternative that they might have faced, which is, you know, doing the mission, then getting halfway back to Earth and finding out that they're going to just run out of air.
Like, yeah,
in the middle of nowhere, that would be worse, I think, in a lot of ways than the stuff that goes on.
Yeah. So at this point, we have three characters being Pinbacker left. We have let's see, Kappa is going through the ship in a golden turtle suit to try to get to the bomb, which has another small point that I really love, which him running through the ship and tripping over the bulkhead trying to get, you have this countdown going, and it's just like, this is so stressful over someone tripping. And I like that. And he's able to get to the bomb by the skin of his teeth. And so it's Kappa, Cassie, and Pinbacker on the nuke cube. And I do like how, with all the stuff talking about how this cube is the size of Manhattan, I do like how it does not, you know, spend too much time with them going, oh, I need to run all this place.
Yeah.
Because they're always just by those stairs. They're just by the space they need to be. So
yes. Yeah, at this point, we know that the only way left to make this work now is that nobody is going to survive what is going to come now.
It's yeah. Like
they have to fly it into the payload into the sun, and that's it. That, and of course, the only thing that's stopping them from doing what they've got to do is pin back like that. So you have Kappa, you have Cassie, you have Pinbacker being basically the last of the lot, and the final bleak point, isn't it? Really, it's like, but we're like many of the characters, we kind of have the acceptance at this point. We know that there is no escape from this. There's no Hail Mary happening here. It is basically, yeah, that's it. It's going to the sun.
Yeah.
There's no way back. Even if you did, there's no way you'd survive. Yeah, and I mean, I suppose the only point that might nullify it slightly is the fact that it kind of demotes the idea of having Pinbacker there, apart from to be sort of potentially stopping, you know, it from getting to the sun. But he becomes a lesser part of the problem, you know, at that point, because it's like, well, you know, nobody's really fearing him at that point because he's just a problem. You know, it's like they know that they're going to die anyway. He's not a threat in that regard, which, yeah, I think is intentional, to be fair, for the film. I think that's the whole point, isn't it? He's just another person caught up in this situation who believes through the madness of being crisped to near death that, you know, the sun wants this, it wants us to die, sort of thing like that. And it's an interesting way to sort of do a final confrontation, I think, don't you?
Yeah, because I mean, I think there is more of a stress trying to get to the bomb and get off of the rest of the Icarus II than there is with the final confrontation with Pinbacker. You know, because as you said, you know, Pinbacker's a person, you know, with because if Kappa was still on the Icarus One, the Icarus Two, when the bomb's payload rockets went off, he would have been crisped, you know. Yeah. It would have been, but this, and there's the final scuffle that they have where you know, he ends up Kappa is held off of the edge of the new cube and basically degloves Pinbacker, which is very metal because you could actually kind of see that. But like that's the end of him after that. You know, like there isn't like a oh, you know, we destroyed the evil, you know, because it's, you know, okay, cool, that's done, but really we need to get this to happen.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big things of I think you could say that, like, you know, maybe Pinbacker is just acting as the sun's last defense in his own mind.
Or even, like, you could use him as an analogy for humanity anyway. You know, like, as the side trying to be logical and sensible about, like, we need to do this to save the Earth, and you still, you know, you get that side of humanity that's like, why?
That,
I like that the temperatures have come down. You know, it's like, yeah, the kind of same things we see with, like, global warming things, you know, where you get people, you know, it was like, it's raining in August all the time, so where's your global warming now, sort of thing, like that. And it's of a similar vein, you know. You're right, it has twofold sort of impressions there, because he can be representing the sun, but also that, I think, as well, which is a good way to view it, because you are getting a microcosm of humanity, a bottled version of it in this ship, you know, and everyone on it doing their job. But, you know, the very human side of them means that there are going to be mistakes and bad opinions and bad views and logic that's so cold it's just cruel at that point. But it's good. I like that about it. Yeah, and I think, as we said before, the naming the ship Icarus and not trying to name and then doing it again for the second ship, it's just like another sort of wonderful little nod, like saying, you didn't learn the whole moral of the story the first time, did you? Like, sort of thing. Like, and we'll try it again. So calling it Icarus the second time is just like the whole definition of insanity thing, isn't it? It's dear. But yeah, that's the good thing is, of course, you know, the finality of it isn't just doom and gloom. You get that, as you said, that last scene on Earth, and it's beautiful, isn't it? It's just, yeah, with Kappa's sister, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, sister and kids in, that's it. Australia, I think. And it's snowy on the ground, and yeah. But then you see that one little burst of sun, and it's all like, oh
yeah, and it just sort of flows over the land, and it's just after she's received that last message, you know, which, as I explained, is, you know, takes time to get there, it was just amazing. Literally, it gives you a lovely little bit of hope in that, and just makes it feel like they struggled. It was horrific, and it kind of made you think of the idea of, like, oh man, all this stuff that people could do to be saving the planet, like that, in a situation like that, and you would never know what happened.
Yeah.
You know, and you would never know what they went through to get to that point. And that's a horrible mystery that would never be solved, you know. And that's, you know, or would it, you know, would they go out there and do something? But at the same time, it's, they'd have nothing to find that would probably tell them anything at that point. So, yeah. It is quite the film, you know, in that regard. It's, as I said, loose sci-fi used in a really direct way, I think, is the best way to put it, because, yeah, as I say, it has the bare bones of what it needs in terms of science fiction without, you know, overcomplicating explanations about it. It's direct, gets on with it, and makes the most of every sort of escalation that it goes on, doesn't it? So, yeah, a thing I like to ask generally with these is, at the end, it's like, not like to be a majorly sort of down note, but to say, is there one criticism you could accept of this film?
One criticism I would have is...
Yeah, it's tricky.
We did kind of talk about the criticism that was there of, you know, Pinbacker's kind of distortion. I do wish that Cassie was given a little more to do, I don't know what that's
kind of this.
It's definitely one of those movies where it's like, oh, I really wish that I could see more of the rest of the crew, you know, because we got a lot of characterization for some of them, but not as much for others. But at the same time, I don't want the movie to be longer. No. Like, I wouldn't want it to be 30 minutes of, you know, everyone chilling in the mess hall.
No, that's that's understandable. You know, I think it's, but, you know, that's the best thing I like to say about this when we get to the end of talking about film on here, is that it's always healthier to have that. You know, you can look at a film that you love and say, you know, yeah, I can understand, you know, how people can be like this about it or like that about it. And you can find, it's a good way of doing things. Yeah, definitely, I think. So, yeah, it doesn't stop this being, you know, a fantastic film. Yeah, and definitely, in my opinion, as well, one of Danny Boyle's best, you know, like that, you know, as much as I'm like a zombie fiend, you know, and I think 28 Days Later is good, you know, this is just scratches that very particular kind of sci-fi itch, you know, like, not to be a heathen here, but, you know, like the original version of Solaris, for instance, is a tad boring compared to the George Clooney version of Solaris, which I was really fascinated by. It's just like, I know, terrible to say, but it's like, it does scratch that same sort of itch, you know, for me. Same thing, same way that First Man did, you know, as well. And, you know, just sci-fi that has a realism but plays up to the fact that it is cinema, you know. And I think there are films that do that, that find that balance quite well. And this is definitely one of the best examples of that.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I do have to say, I love watching, you know, some older movies, some classics, and there is definitely some times where you go and, you know, you're sitting there in at 2 hours and 45 minutes in Seven Samurai, and you're like, oh, wow, this movie's 3.5 hours long.
Yeah, and you feel it. Yeah, it does happen.
But that being said, like, it does seem like the watchability and the flow of something, it can really just make a movie sing.
It can, and you know that isn't exclusive to newer films either. That they, you know, you can get older films that are multiple hours long and still be finding yourself entranced and enchanted by them. So yeah, it's finding that perfect formula. But they're usually the ones that are across the balance of being beloved by, you know, people who are more into movies and people who just like going to the movies. You know? So I think, that's a good balance to find. So thank you for bringing Sunshine to the show. And
Of course.
Yeah, it's a pleasure having you on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Not a problem. That is it for this episode of our Punch Drunk Loves. We will be back with another guest, another film soon. Until then, go show your Punch Drunk Love to your favorite.